Today is Wednesday, December 7th. I'm Bill Murphy here with the front pages. I'll be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant, and we will take a look at the pictures on the front pages of each paper. On the front page of the Times, there's a picture of a school in Malotarnivka, Ukraine, and it was hit by a missile. Picture of the school. It's a brick building. Most of it looks like it's still standing, but big ditch in front of it and a lot of debris, and there are some soldiers inspecting the area. It says that in Russia, this air base was apparently targeted by a Ukrainian drone. Underneath, if you heard the sports today, I mentioned the World Cup. Morocco defeated Spain in penalty kicks and moved on to the World Cup quarterfinal. That was the first Arab nation to ever move on. There's an overhead shot of the Moroccan players celebrating after their victory. Over to the Current, two pictures. One is a picture of some people who are moving into the Farmington School Board meeting on Monday about the decision to eliminate Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur from the calendar, and also Diwali. I'm going to have a story on that. The headline is Board Flips on Jewish Holidays. And the picture is just those people moving in. There's a sign of complaint below the fence there. It's very difficult to read what it says. That's it. Pretty much the building is all lighted and ready for the meeting to take place. That was on Monday. And then the other picture, I'll read the caption. Winter is just a couple of weeks away. So the Connecticut Department of Transportation held an open house in Rocky Hill on Tuesday to demonstrate the work that its teams do to repair equipment and fabricate parts. And this is a picture. It's difficult to see. It's in the evening, so it's pretty dark. But a picture of a welder. His name is Jeff Conifal, and he is doing some welding on the equipment. And it says this keeps the fleet of trucks running safely during inclement weather, which undoubtedly we'll be having very soon, since already into December. So there's no story on that. That's just the picture. We'll go into the two stories that I have now. These stories are from the New York Times. And the first one is the Trump Organization, the family real estate business that made Donald J. Trump a billionaire and propelled him from reality television to the White House, was convicted on Tuesday of tax fraud and other crimes, forever tarring the former president and the company that bears his name. The conviction on all 17 counts, after more than a day of jury deliberations in state Supreme Court in Manhattan, stemmed from the company's practice of doling out off-the-books perks to executives. They received luxury apartments, leased Mercedes-Benzes, extra cash at Christmas, even free cable television. They paid taxes on none of it. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office, which prosecuted the case, had previously obtained a guilty plea from the scheme's architect, Alan H. Weisselberg, the company's longtime chief financial officer. Mr. Weisselberg, one of Mr. Trump's most loyal lieutenants, testified as a prosecution star witness, but never implicated the former president. Prosecutors did not charge Mr. Trump, but they did invoke him throughout the month-long trial, telling jurors that he had personally paid for some of the perks and had even approved a crucial aspect of the scheme. The prosecution sounded a drumbeat of damning evidence about a free-willing culture at his company, revealing that persuasive illegality flourished there for years. We've got to see our inner workings of the Trump Organization, the greed, the lies, the cheating, the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin L. Bragg said in an interview on Tuesday evening, reflecting on a victory that marked the height of his young tenure. The verdict carries limited financial repercussions and will not directly threaten to imperil Mr. Trump's company, but the conviction and the prosecution's explosive claim in closing arguments that Mr. Trump had been explicitly sanctioning tax fraud could reverberate through his nascent 2024 presidential campaign, providing fodder for political opponents. It also expected to embolden Mr. Bragg as he intensifies his broader criminal investigation into Mr. Trump, which focuses both on his business practices and on hush money paid to a porn star who has said she had an affair with him, according to people with knowledge of the matter. Mr. Bragg came under fire earlier this year after he declined to seek an indictment of Mr. Trump. It is unclear whether Mr. Trump will now face charges, but of all his legal entanglements, including two federal criminal investigations involving his final days as president, none has been as personally embarrassing as the district attorney's inquiry. In a relatively muted statement, Mr. Trump said he was disappointed with the verdict, but planned to appeal. He blamed Mr. Weisenberg, saying the case was about his, quote, committing tax fraud on his personal tax returns. And I have another story that's on the front page of the Times. Representative Benny Thompson, the chairman of the House panel investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol on Tuesday, gave the strongest signal yet that the panel planned to make criminal referrals to the Justice Department, raising the prospect of a history-making finding that former President Donald J. Trump's efforts to cling to power after he lost the 2020 election amounted to a crime. In comments to reporters that appeared to preempt a formal decision by the committee, Mr. Thompson, the Mississippi Democrat, said the panel had yet to agree on whom to recommend for charges on which crimes to blame a name. But his remarks, including a contorted attempt to qualify his initial statement, suggested that as the committee members wrap up their work, they are heavily inclined toward calling for prosecutions of those involved in the January 6th riot and the months-long election subversion effort directed by Mr. Trump that gave rise to it. A criminal referral by the panel would be largely symbolic, holding no legal weight, because Congress has no enforcement power and no formal say in what the Justice Department does. The department has been carrying out a criminal investigation into Mr. Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election, including the appointment last month of a special counsel who authorized a round of subpoenas after taking over. Yet a referral would be another remarkable development in a precedent-shattering investigation by Congress of Mr. Trump's bid to nullify his defeat and could increase the pressure on Merrick B. Garland, the Attorney General, to bring prosecution. Increased talk of actions by the House committee came as more details were revealed about how the special counsel is investigating Mr. Trump and his allies. If members of the panel agree to move forward with criminal referrals, essentially sending letters to the Justice Department laying out evidence of specific crimes, they would be creating a roadmap for prosecutors in granular detail of how they contend Mr. Trump and his allies broke the law. The committee has interviewed more than 1,000 witnesses, including some of Mr. Trump's closest confidants, and examined reams of text messages, emails, and notes. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming and the vice chairman of the committee, has publicly said that she believes Mr. Trump broke the law, and a federal judge in a court filing earlier this year asserted that Mr. Trump and a little-known conservative lawyer, John Eastman, probably broke the law when they concocted a scheme for then-Vice President Mike Pence to ignore legitimate electoral votes for Joseph R. Biden. They want the votes to be illegitimate from selected people who were elected as a alternative. The disclosure from Mr. Thompson about the plans to make referrals appeared far from choreographed and was in line with off-the-cuff statements he made throughout the investigation, in which he, much to the chagrin of his public affairs aides and other committee members, had publicly dropped major hints in the direction of the investigation. Mr. Thompson initially told reporters on Capitol Hill that the panel had agreed to make criminal referrals and would meet later on Tuesday to discuss the specifics. But within moments, he and the staff rushed to clarify his statements, reflecting a debate that is still underway within the panel about how far to go in formally accusing Mr. Trump and some of his top allies of crimes. What we've decided is that we will probably make referrals, Mr. Thompson told reporters in a short time later. Mr. Thompson was known for giving big-picture guidance about the investigation, but being at times less involved in the granular details of his work, then appeared to contradict himself again, suggesting that the decision was no longer in question. is a general agreement. We will do some referrals, but they've got to get there. Mr. Thompson said we're not there yet. His comments came before the committee had taken any formal action on the issue, probably reflecting a kind of informal consensus among members of the committee that has typically driven their major decisions. A subcommittee of four lawyers on the panel, Representatives Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming, Jamie Raskin, Democrat of Maryland, Zoe Lofgren, Democrat of California, and Adam B. Schiff, Democrat of California, has studied whether to issue criminal referrals to the Justice Department for Mr. Trump or others, and was planning to brief colleagues on the group's recommendations. Among the potential charges the members have considered recommending are conspiracy to defraud the United States and obstruction of an official proceeding of Congress. Regardless of how the committee unfurls this decision, Mr. Thompson publicly broadcast something that many members of Congress have regarded as an open secret about where the committee's work was headed. For the past year, it has weaponized the issue of criminality to try to demonstrate to the public the severity of Mr. Trump's conduct and push the Justice Department to use its criminal powers to charge him. And we're going to move over now to the Hartford Courant, and I have a few stories on the front page. The candlelight glow of the National Vigil for All the Victims of Gun Violence first filled the Washington, D.C. church on a December night in 2013, a somber reminder that 1 year had passed since 20 children and six educators were killed at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Parents, siblings, spouses, and survivors from Connecticut filled the National Cathedral, gripping tightly to photos of their loved ones who were just murdered, many of them just 6 and 7 years old. On Wednesday, just 1 week from the 10-year remembrance of the tragedy that forever changed Newtown, altered the lives of 26 families, and shifted the national conversations on gun control and school safety, Connecticut mourners will again file into a church in our nation's capital, candles in hand, to remember those who were taken from them. The 10th annual National Vigil for All Victims of Gun Violence will begin at 7 p.m. Wednesday at St. Mark's Episcopal Church on Capitol Hill. The day before, survivors, families, and activists will deliver handwritten letters to lawmakers as they continue to fight for legislative changes. The annual event is hosted by the Newtown Action Alliance Foundation, the charitable arm of the Newtown Action Alliance, a nonprofit started after the tragedy. The organization's goal is to support families and survivors directly impacted by gun violence and to unite the movements to end gun violence across the nation. Members of the Newtown Action Alliance and its youth program, the Junior Newtown Action Alliance, boarded a bus in Newtown early Wednesday morning to travel to the vigil, where they will share their stories with fellow survivors and stand in the candlelight holding photos of their loved ones. Connecticut survivors, activists, and victims will join Mothers United Against Violence, parents of children killed in the mass shooting in Uvalde, Texas, organizers of the March for Our Lives, faith leaders, lawmakers, leaders of gun violence prevention, organizations, and activists from all over the United States. Each representing people will have experienced gun violence with the goal of uniting their mission, messages, and memories of those key to they have lost. And there is a site that you can go to visit the vigil live. I'm not going to read it because it's very, very long and complicated. Imagine if you go online and just say to take you to the vigil site that's going to be taking place on a Wednesday. That will probably get you there. I just don't think you'd be able to copy or remember this long four-line site that they have.